Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 10th of May. This hour is all things political, which you always hear on Monday at 9 o'clock. We're going to have a special emphasis on David Obey's retirement during the course of this hour, but of course we'll always be talking about the big political news, and some of it came yesterday with the president deciding to nominate Eleni Kagan for the Supreme Court. We will talk about that a little bit later this hour. David Obey, of course, is a big figure in Wisconsin and very, very important, nationally, and very important to the state of Wisconsin as well. We'll have two guests with us this hour. Glenn Moberg is going to join us. He is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, a producer, a host of Route 51 for Wisconsin Public Radio, and he has been covering Congressman Obey's reign for quite some time because Congressman Obey has reigned for quite some time. Former Congressman Steve Gunderson will also join us during this hour. He is now President and Chief Executive Officer of the Council on Foundations. He's a former U.S. Congressman and member of the Wisconsin State Legislature, and he served 8 terms in the House with Congressman Obey. So more of the calls that deal with the presidential nomination for the Supreme Court and other all things political, more the second half hour. But Congressman David Obey is a huge figure here in the state of Wisconsin and nationally, and we thought he is very worthy of a good chunk of our conversation for all things political. You're welcome to join this conversation during this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Glenn Moberg is joining us now from Wausau. Hello, Glenn, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen, how are you doing this morning?
I'm all right. How are you?
Not bad.
Good. I was interested in what Bob Schieffer said about Obey. Smart, powerful, sometimes cranky. Any other adjectives you want to add?
Well, I would describe him as one of the last of the unapologetic New Deal liberals. He was a man whose worldview was really determined, I think, by the Great Depression and World War II, which he lived through as a young boy. And the lessons that he says he learned from those events, that a strong federal government has to be involved in regulating Wall Street and the economy, helping the poor, the middle class, the working class, and protecting them from powerful economic interests. He would argue that without a strong government, we wouldn't have recovered from the Depression, won World War II, and turned America into the world's superpower. So that was really where he was coming from. And he was described by his longtime friend James Lawrence, who helped him write his autobiography, Raising Hell for Justice, as the last of the unapologetic New Deal liberals, or at least one of the last. He's really part of a dying breed.
I had heard that he used to be an Eisenhower Republican. Is that true? And how did he switch parties?
It kind of. He was actually a Joe McCarthy Republican. When he was young, in the 50s, of course, the Korean War was going on, and he had problems with his family had problems with Harry Truman's decision to fire General MacArthur. And then Joe McCarthy came on the scene, and as a young Republican, Dave Obey tells a story about him hitching his little red wagon to the back of his bicycle and delivering Joe McCarthy literature door to door in Wausau when he was still in grade school. He later had a chance to see McCarthy at the Elks Club in Wausau, and he writes in his autobiography that he was shocked by McCarthy's demeanor, by the vicious attacks on his political opponents, and just the way he conducted himself, at the Elks Club. So that was one of the things that disillusioned him. He also had some experiences as a young Republican in grade school and later in high school. He had a history teacher who inspired him in high school, helped to turn him around. Dave Obey had a troubled childhood. His parents got divorced. They were under a lot of economic stress. His dad worked a full-time shift at the 3M company here in Wausau, and he also rehabilitated and sold houses in order to help the family get by. So Dave moved from one home to another, all during his childhood. And the family was always under great economic stress, and that that really contributed to him being in trouble a lot during grade school. He tells a story about one time a nun at a Catholic grade school gave him the back of his hand because he was being inattentive, and he punched her out.
Woo!
In seventh grade. Maybe there's a little bit of the Dave Obey temper showing at an early age. But he skipped school. He was almost expelled. He had lousy grades. And then he credits some teachers in high school, particularly one, with helping to turn that around by helping him develop an interest in politics that he already had, and teaching him how to argue from both sides of an issue to see that there's more than one way of looking at things. That teacher, he writes again in his autobiography, came under attack by Republicans on the school board for being a Bolshevik,
oh my goodness,
for being a socialist. So that left Dave with a bad taste in his mouth, and he also writes about how he went to a young Republican meeting, and there was a speaker there who gave the entire Ayn Rand talk that selfishness is good and greed is good and the poor deserve whatever they've gotten because they're lazy, shiftless, and unions are bad, and the rich should be able to keep whatever they've earned. He says he left feeling that there was no place in the Republican Party for a working class stiff like him. So it was the Great Depression, it was World War II, and then those experiences during his troubled childhood while his parents were getting divorced and under economic stress that really changed him from being a Republican to a Democrat. And he never really lost those values. If I can just tell one real quick story.
Of course.
His father went to the hospital for an emergency appendectomy when he was young, and his father came back paralyzed in both arms.
Oh.
And they don't know why. They thought maybe it was the anesthetic. He writes that that was back before people sued other people for things like that. But the family was convinced that they would become destitute and poverty-stricken. Dad later recovered the use of his arms, but the experience really left a lasting impression on Obie that many working people are just one tragedy away from poverty and disaster. And that also spurred a lifelong interest that he had in making sure that universal health care became a reality, which, of course, it did during his last term in Congress. And he often told people, facetiously, it seemed at the time, people would ask him, when are you finally going to retire? And he said, when we finally pass universal health care and get a bill on the president's desk, which sounded at the time like, well, that's when hell freezes over. But we did get the health care bill passed. It did get signed into law. Dave Obey was very proud that he was sitting in that speaker's chair wielding the gavel when the final version of the bill passed Congress, and Dave Obey kept his word, and he retired. And incidentally, hell did freeze over. We had a blizzard the next weekend up here in the Wausau area.
Right. Let's listen to his announcement that he is retiring because he's understandably so bone tired.
I've won 25 elections. Does anybody really think I don't know how to win another one? Or for that matter, has anybody ever seen me walk away from a fight in my life? The fact is there isn't a chance of a snowball in Hades of that progressive congressional district electing someone who is a poor imitation of George Bush's policies on a bad day. For six straight years under George W. Bush, over 90% of all the income growth in the country went into the pockets of the wealthiest 10%. The other 90% of the population, the regular people of this country, got table scraps. I deeply regret not being able to do more to turn that around. There has to be more to life than explaining the ridiculous, accountability-destroying rules of the United States Senate to confused and angry and frustrated constituents.
Oh, I'm going to miss hearing comments like that, Glenn. Whatever you think of him, this guy was direct, and he is sharp.
He spoke his mind.
Yes.
And of course, when he announced that he was retiring, this is supposed to be a bad year for Democrats, a bad year for incumbents. And he's got a couple of very vocal opponents in his district, a guy named Sean Duffy, who is gotten a lot of national attention. He's the district attorney in Ashland County, and the guy who ran against him 2 years ago, Dan Mielke, is also not going quietly into the night. There have been some private polls. I haven't seen any public ones indicating that maybe Dave would have had to, had a race on his hands. But, you know, you heard the defiance there. I've won 25 elections. Does anybody think that I wouldn't win another one? You also heard the economic populism, the fact that right. he's really concerned, I think, first and foremost by the unequal distribution of wealth in this country, the fact that the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, the middle class is disappearing. And he's a person who believes in the progressive income tax system.
And, what is it?
Believes that... Go on.
No, finish, please.
Yeah, well, he believes that government has a role of helping people and to a certain extent redistributing wealth. He often said the role of government is take the edge off of capitalism so it works for everyone.
What about Wisconsin losing some of its influence and his not being able to bring home some goodies as a result of his retiring? Is that a fairly substantial thing, Glenn?
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. This was the man who had the he was third in line in seniority in the House of Representatives, and he was the chairman of the very powerful House Ways and Means House Appropriations Committee, and he used that to help people in his district. He brought so much into the district that many people who were ideologically opposed to him, many Republicans would vote for him every 2 years because of the things that he could do for the people in the individual communities in his district. I'll give you some examples here. At North Central Technical College, there's a $20 million Dave Obey Center for Health Sciences. If you drive north from Madison on Interstate 39, you'll see this huge interchange with Highway 29 just west of Wausau. It looks like you're in downtown Chicago on the Spaghetti Bowl. he put that in. The Marathon County Center for Civic Engagement. Here's a something that we should probably let people know. This is where our new Wisconsin Public Radio studios are going to be.
Oh.
A $10 million building that's going up here at UW-Marathon County, which is his alma mater. It's also going to be a theater center and the Center for the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service, a think tank that we've got at UWMC. A wastewater treatment plant in Nakusa. A business park for Wood County in Buren, in Wisconsin Rapids, the Rapids East Commerce Center, expansion of Highway 10 in the Stevens Point area, Ministry Dental Center. This was something that he was very proud of, bringing dental clinics to help people who, especially during the recession, had lost their insurance and couldn't afford dental care. The Laird Center for Medical Research in Marshfield. In Abbotsford, they've had problems with the quality of their well water, so he put in water wells and a treatment plant. And in downtown Wausau, the Arts Block Center and
Goodness.
The renovation of the Grand Theater. All of this, and this is just some of what he's done.
Isn't
so,
that something?
Whoever gets elected, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, you know, the spigot is going to be turned off for a while. And Dave was a big advocate of earmarks, you know, and some in this district would say he gave pork barrel spending a good name.
Glenn Moberg is with us, the first half hour of our program, reporter, producer, host of Route 51 for Wisconsin Public Radio. Glenn joining us by phone from Wausau, where, of course, David Obey was raised. He went to Wausau High School, and we're looking at his decision to retire, but more importantly, what he's been able to bring to the state of Wisconsin and how we have lost a very potent voice for people of Wisconsin and people nationally, too. He certainly was a very important figure for a long time in Congress, perhaps most recently with passage of health care legislation, which is something that made him happy. We have a couple more clips to play, a congressional debate in 2008 and also an interview segment a little later on with historian James Lawrence, the writer who assisted Obey with his autobiography. So all of that coming up. And we welcome your phone calls, too. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political. With the news that is very large for the state of Wisconsin, the retirement of Congressman Dave Obie, we thought we would devote a good portion of this week's program to that issue and to his importance to the state. We would like to hear from you. Did I give you the email? talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glenn Moberg joining us the first half hour. This is, set this up for us, Glenn. This is a clip from a congressional debate in 2008.
Yes, Dave Obie was very famous for his short fuse and his quick temper, which was sort of like the ugly side. You know, and I'm speaking about him like he's in past tense, and he isn't. Dave is very much with us and very much a factor in Washington right now. But that passion would often come out during political exchanges. In fact, when I first moved up here from Chicago in 1993, I was hired to be an anchor and news director at the CBS affiliate in town, Channel 7. And I had Obie on as a guest, and I experienced that anger the first time I did a live interview with him. I was trying to put him on the spot, you know, and I can't even remember the question I asked, but he turned to me and he says, "You know, Mr. Moberg, with all due respect." If I can give you my Obie impression, when he says "with all due respect," you brace yourself because right. That means he's going to hit you with both barrels. And he says, "That, without a doubt, is the most ignorant and uninformed question ever heard from anyone who professes to be in your alleged profession."
Oh my gosh!
You better be prepared if you're going to talk to Dave Obie, because he suffers no fools.
What did you say to him, Glenn?
Well, I asked the question over again, and I explained to him why I didn't think it was a stupid question, and he answered it. But it was, and another thing he'll do if you're with the press and you ask him a tough question, he won't answer directly. He'll turn around and ask you a question. You know, "Let me ask you a question," and it'll invariably be, "How many Republicans and Democrats do you think supported this back in 1967? When it first came?" And of course, you don't have the answer to it, so you have to say, "I don't know." And he says, "Well, let me tell you." So this clip you're going to hear, this is a debate with him and Dan Mielke, who's running again for Congress this year. He's one of, I think there are three Republicans in the race. This was in Wausau. And you can see Mr. Mielke and Mr. Obie getting into it over economic policy.
Herbert Hoover's answer was the same as Mr. Mielke's. Do nothing.
Smart man.
Don't inject Herbert Hoover. Well, we've got a real different view of history.
Obviously.
The idea that progressive taxation is socialistic is preposterous. Bob La Follette invented the idea.
Spreading the wealth.
But I would not be surprised to see Mr. Mielke call it socialist, since he's already called me a traitor because I have the temerity to question
the
war.
I said anyone who speaks negatively about the troops, aids and abets the enemy, or undermines the effort is guilty of
negative about the troops. I think it is an abomination that our government has become a defender of torture on the world stage.
And that was in 2008, right, Glenn?
Right.
Oh, my. That's quite a clip. Let's take
And you know, it's a reference to Herbert Hoover.
You know,
there's that depression. And he'd express visceral frustration with young conservatives who he would say have not learned the lesson of history. The Republican Party and Herbert Hoover caused the Great Depression. They almost caused a second Great Depression in 2008. And it was only, the federal government and Dave Obie would say the stimulus package that he helped write that pulled us back from the abyss.
Let's go to a phone call. Frank is joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
Hi.
Your guest gave a lot of good reasons and demonstrated very well how Mr. Obie was able to bring home the pork for the people of Wisconsin. I'd be more interested in hearing about how did David Obie stand for the people of Wisconsin in supporting and defending the Constitution. For example, abiding by the constitutional requirement that Congress declare war and that the armed forces of the United States are not the under the sole discretion of the administration. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution requiring that no state make anything but gold and silver coin and tender a payment as debt and things like that.
All right. Thanks, Frank.
Well, I think in terms of military adventures overseas, Mr. Obi opposed to the war in Iraq. He voted against the additional 30,000 troops for Afghanistan, and he would very much agree that Congress has a role in declaring war and determining defense policy for the United States. He would not agree at all with the idea of returning to some sort of a gold standard. As I said, he was he's a New Deal liberal who believes that the government has an important role to play in determining economic prosperity and in regulating the economy.
What kind of relationship did he have with President Obama?
He thought, I asked him that question on Wednesday. He did a conference call with reporters, and he said it's too early to see if, what kind of a President Obama is going to be. But he did say that he thought he's off to a really magnificent start in terms of, again, pulling the economy back from the brinks of a depression, passing universal health care, which is something that nobody ever thought would happen. He ticked off a couple of other accomplishments. During the primary season, Dave Obi was not a supporter of Barack Obama right away. He supported John Edwards for president. Of course, that was before the scandal that has ruined Mr. Edwards' life. But it was largely because of John Edwards' Two Americas point of view, the idea that there's a rich America and a poor America, and the middle class is disappearing.
Right. And then there's America for John Edwards.
Yes.
Yeah, that's quite a story. I have heard that he really wrote the stimulus bill. Was it his hand that was behind that?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. As the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, of course, he couldn't do it all by himself. But that bill that ended up on the president's desk had his signatures on it. Now, he was not happy that it wasn't as large as he wanted it to be. Here's another Obiism. You don't shoot a grizzly bear with a BB gun, something he said when he was trying to get the stimulus measure passed. And he predicted in February of last year that even if his stimulus bill was passed, that unemployment would hit 10% and go above it. He said if we didn't do it, again, the alternative was another Great Depression.
This is part of an interview. Well, tell us about this with historian James Lawrence. We're about to hear.
Yeah, James Lawrence knew has known Dave Obi since 1966, and I was able to get together with him on Wednesday morning, really within about a half hour of the announcement, and get his impression of what really made Dave Obi tick.
That is maybe the key to Dave's success. He never did too well in the small towns, and he usually broke even in Wausau, but did very well in rural districts and, of course, with workers, with labor. He's one of the last of the true mainstream liberals who is unabashed and, and not fearful of saying what he stands for and standing for the interests of average working people. I don't think you're going to find that kind of a champion in the near future. So, it would be very difficult to replace what he has become for the lives of working people in this district.
And it's perhaps hard to imagine too many people in Congress who have that kind of New Deal fighting spirit.
Fewer and fewer all the time.
Right.
Fewer all the time. His good friend John Murtaugh passed away this past year. But what I found interesting is that's how he got elected year after year. It was support in the rural communities. The farmers supported him. Labor, he barely broke even in his hometown of Wausau and the other big cities, and he lost the small towns. But that attachment with the farmers goes back to his first run in 1969. when, again, nobody gave him a chance of winning election. He beat Walter John Chilson at the time, who was in the state Senate and also a former broadcaster. He was the anchorman at Channel 7 all through the 50s and 60s. Walter John is still around today. I consider him to be a good friend of mine, a very intelligent, thoughtful, moderate person. He was supposed to walk away with that election in 1969, but what happened was Richard Nixon's Secretary of Agriculture refused to raise the milk price supports. And in the last couple of weeks of the campaign, Obie hammered that, and he tied Walter John to Nixon as much as he could. And he ended up pulling off this upset with the help of farmers who supported him en masse, never really left him through the years. In 1969, Kathleen, when he was elected, he was the first Democrat ever to be elected to Congress in Marathon County, back to the Civil War and the birth of the Republican Party.
Oh, what a fascinating history this is. We have to have you on again for a full hour. Where is he going now? Is he going to come back to Wausau, or do you have any idea?
Well, he lives here, and he says, what else did he say? He said, I'm not going away. So I think he's going to weigh in on political issues. He plans to spend more time with his family and his what he would describe as his long-suffering wife, Joan. She was going to marry a history teacher, and she ended up with this politician on her hands. He's going to spend time at his cabin in the North Woods, and I suspect we'll be hearing his opinions.
Well, I hope he entertains visitors. Thank you so much, Glenn, for being with us. Thanks. We'll talk again.
Kathleen, thank you.
Glenn Moberg, reporter, producer, host of Route 51 for Wisconsin Public Radio. And he, of course, has been covering David Obie, Congressman Obie, for a number of years. We are going to be continuing a little bit of conversation about Obie because it was such a huge news story in the state of Wisconsin. And we'll also be entertaining questions about the big news story of the last couple days, which is President Obama has decided to nominate Lenny Kagan to the Supreme Court. Joining us now is Steve Gunderson. Steve is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Council on Foundations, which is a Washington, D.C.-based membership association of more than 2,000 grant-making foundations and corporations. We know him, of course, here in Wisconsin for serving 16 years in the U.S. Congress, 3 terms in the Wisconsin State Legislature, and he has been working at that time for preparing America's citizens and indirectly the organization supporting them for 21st century global economy. He is the author of The Jobs Revolution, Changing How America Works, and he retired from public service in 1996, recognized as a leader on agriculture, education, employment policy, healthcare, and human rights issues. And he is joining us today. He served with Congressman Obie for a number of years in Congress, 8 terms, actually, in the House with Obie. We'll continue phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And Steve Gunderson, thank you so much for being with us. Long time no talk. Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. Glad to do it.
Yeah, real nice to have you here. Well, Bob Schieffer wrote this interesting piece when Obie made his announcement that he could remember a time, and I'm wondering if you remember this time too, social occasions when you were in the House, when you would get together with Obie, when Democrats and Republicans who had disagreements during the day actually enjoyed each other's company during the evening hours. Did there used to be such a time? Has it passed?
Yeah, it's definitely passed, and regrettably so, and I think it defines both the Dave Obie and the politics of old and probably the frustration that David has had in the more current years, because we used to have very, very intense partisan debates on the floor of the House, and I used to say that, you know, Tip O'Neill and Bob Michael would go down to the White House and have drinks with Ronald Reagan afterward because they understood the difference between the politics of the moment on the floor of the House. And there was not at that time the politics of personal destruction. And that's all changed. Now, if you are a true believer on the right or left, you have to literally hate the people on the other side. And you have to not want to associate with them. So it's a total cultural change. I always say, I'm really, really glad I was in Congress.
and I'm really, really glad I'm not there right now.
What happened?
Well, I think what happened, and this is my own political science analysis, and that is as our districts became safe districts, safe Democrat or safe Republican districts, all of a sudden the party that controlled that district made the nomination process a purity test, a litmus test. On a Democratic side, it was you have to be the most liberal of the candidates. On the Republican side, it meant you had to be the most conservative. And so what you have is you have people who are true believers of the right or the left, and you don't have any of those in the great center who work across partisan lines to solve problems. I mean, as the last discussion just talked about, when Dave Obey went to Congress, he represented a district that had been represented by Mel Laird, and people saw it as a marginally Republican district. When I went to Congress, we had a marginally Democratic district, and so we both had incentives at that time to work together, and party lines, while they had some definition of who we were and what we stood for, they weren't the defining moment of our congressional career and our congressional actions.
We spent some time talking with Glenn about what Congressman Obey was able to bring back to the state of Wisconsin, and the list was just unbelievable. Will that be sorely missed? Can you see somebody else filling those shoes?
In the short term, no. In the long term, probably. But I think we ought not underestimate the power of seniority and certainly the power of chairmanships of certain committees. It's going to be a huge economic cost to Wisconsin because Dave could make sure that the formulas and the funding mechanisms at least didn't penalize states like Wisconsin. And so I think that this is going to have a significant impact on the state and the resources that come back. And anyone who says to the contrary isn't looking at the map.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to take phone calls for you in just one moment. I'm interested because another big story, of course, today is the president is going to nominate Elena Kagan to this U.S. Supreme Court. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that, you know, Supreme Court nominations used to also be much more bipartisan than they have been recently. I think those fights are reflective, and it is all the talk over the weekend was that you will see the advocacy in the opposition groups trying to define her in ways that will allow them to raise money for their organization. And so this becomes much more about the politics in the short term and much less about what is the overall role of the court moving forward. And I think that's just reflective of the politics of the day.
You sound so discouraged, Steve Gunderson. Is there a way to change this kind of atmosphere?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, so don't let me come off as being discouraged here. These are cycles. If you read history, you will find that there were some incredibly polarized partisan cycles previously in American history, and we recovered from all of those. I also think that if you combine the present polarization of politics with also what is the impact of an economically challenged economy, I think those two elements together really poison the atmosphere for public policy, because whenever you are in an economic decline, you will have appropriately people sort of, you know, Katie barred the door, and you see that in so many ways in our social issues today. I mean, I was thinking about over this weekend when I knew I was going to be on your call. I mean, what are the odds that in 2010 we could pass any kind of a civil rights legislation today? I think everybody would say there's not a chance. I mean, I remember under Bush 1, with strong, strong Republican support, we passed the Americans with Disability Act. There's no chance in today's environment where you would see the Congress on a bipartisan basis doing something which enhanced opportunities for any segment of our population.
What about immigration reform? Do you think that because of the response to what's happened in Arizona, everybody's going to be pressed to take up this issue and soon?
I think actually it would be dangerous to take it up soon, because I think that what you would see is people voting on short-term political expediency rather than what was a rational immigration policy. I mean, regardless of whether you're Republican or Democrat, I guess we'll look at John McCain as an example. John McCain was one of those people just a couple years ago where he was advocating a pretty balanced, thought-out immigration policy that, on the one hand, you do better enforcement, but you've got to do something with the 8 to 10 million illegal immigrants who are here, who have families, etc. Look at where John McCain is on that issue today, and
yes,
that's primarily driven, I think, by the need for him to position himself in a way that will allow him to survive politically in Arizona as he tries to get renominated.
So you think that's the way politics is these days? You have to do that to survive, be you a Democrat or be you a Republican?
I think we are in the short-term era of political survival. I think you've seen that in some of the recent primaries. Only look at what happened in Utah over the weekend with Senator Bennett.
Right.
And so when you have a state or a congressional district that is not competitive, it's Republican or Democrat. In Utah's case, it's a very Republican district. They put him through the litmus test on ideological purity and decided that he didn't meet that standard. And so I think we've got to wait this one out. We've got to get some of an economic recovery, and then we can move forward.
We'll welcome phone calls for you. Steve Gunderson is joining us this part of the program, president now and chief executive officer of the Council on Foundations. He, of course, a longtime member of Congress from Wisconsin and a member of the Wisconsin State Legislature as well. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Believing that Congress was never meant to be a life career, Gunderson voluntarily retired from public service in 1996. He was a recognized leader during his time there in agriculture, education, employment policy, health care, human rights issues. His distinguished career also included leadership roles on AIDS policy, modernization of our nation's employment policy, lifelong learning, community learning centers, and job training policies. He served as co-chair of the bipartisan Rural Healthcare Coalition. To your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Steve Gunderson joining us now. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let's go to some phone calls. We start with Julianne from Suamico. Hi, Julianne.
Hello, Kathy and your guest. I have a four-part comment. Basically, the first thing I want to say is I was an occupational corporate nurse in the largest meatpacking company in Wisconsin, so I do have a lot of experience. One of the things I want to say is that so often we hear that immigration from Mexico has come here because white people do not want to do the jobs for the pay and the circumstances. And I think that maybe we ought to address those reasons, okay? Secondly, we hear about the Arizona reform, and everyone is protesting that we're breaking the law and acting against their rights. Well, they have no rights because they're not legal citizens, okay? And thirdly, no one mentioned when Obama had his inaugural parade that there is so much segregation still in these high schools that one group was all black. And occasionally you would see a white person in there or you'd see a whole white band. So I don't think we've improved civil rights one bit since the 60s. And lastly, in the Navy they announced 2 weeks ago that women were going to be admitted into nuclear power school. And I dated a man in the Vietnam War who had, and my brother, completed nuclear power school and were on the subs. I just want to say that Ms. Kagan might be the first in law fields, but I was the first woman to sit inside the control room of a nuclear-powered submarine when the reactor was critical.
Okay. Steve, you want to respond to any of that?
Well, I want to congratulate her for being the first to do that, number one. Number two, I think she is right that, you know, the line that the most segregated hour of America's week is Sunday morning at our churches. And, I mean, the reality is, we have a long way to go to truly integrate America in terms of the diverse cultures that we have. As I mentioned in my earlier comments, I don't think we can have should I say, adult conversations about that when you have the kind of economic stress that we have today. So I think it's not going to happen in the short term.
I know that you're author of The Jobs Revolution, Changing How America Works. Please give us your thoughts, and I know that we could talk hours about this, but how the administration needs to deal with the unemployment rate, how we need to spark job growth in this country right now, Steve.
Well, I think, let me go way back and try to put this in some perspective. I'm one of those Republicans who said some kind of an economic stimulus was absolutely necessary. I think this economy was on the brink of absolute collapse, and so I believe a stimulus was necessary. What I would have done as a Republican is I would have probably spent some of that money differently than how it was spent. I understand why they made the decisions to use the current programs, but I think when you have the kind of economic change that is undergoing right now, you have to invest in that change and certainly the impact of that change on people. There are two or three things that I think become really critical here. We have a whole generation of American workers who were literally told, graduate from high school and go to work in American manufacturing, and you will be fine for the rest of your life. Those American manufacturing jobs have either been eliminated or certainly substantially reduced. And so we have to figure out how do we support the retraining of a significant adult population. The second thing which I think is a really telling statistic is if you look at the average wage for a high school graduate, and you look at the average wage for somebody with 2 years of post-high school education, what you will find is that person with just 2 years of post-high school education has approximately twice the annual salary for the rest of their life every year as compared to that high school graduate. So in terms of return on investment from an American investment in education and training, it is the 2 years after high school that literally change all of that. And so I really think that at some point we're going to have a conversation about pre-K 14 in terms of a comprehensive education foundation for all American workers as we try to prepare. You can't stop the global economy. It's here. It's going to be here. It's going to continue to increase. You know, that argument that we had probably 10, 20 years ago is no longer an argument we can have with technology and communication and travel that exists today. So we've got to figure out how it is we're going to prepare the American population to succeed in this kind of an economy.
Let's go to more phone calls. Sherry from Eau Claire is next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. You made a comment earlier about the old ways in politics. I have been so distraught, disappointed, and disgusted from our politicians in the last many years. And I don't know if it's the explosion of media with cable, but it seems to me that our role models as politicians are spending more time negatively talking about other politicians, about the other parties, and there's so much disagreement in that respect and the negative conversations that are on the media that it shows that there's, I mean, it makes me realize that how can they get anything done when there's so much negative talk to each party about each individual in politics? And it is just disappointing. How can we get past this? Because the day of showing that you can have a disagreement and working through that, I don't see it anymore in politics.
Okay, Steve Gunderson.
Well, I tend to agree with you, and I think that there are a couple of things that might have to happen here, one of which is we as a nation have got to reject the politics of personal destruction. The reason that people keep running negative campaign ads is because they unfortunately work. And until people literally, in essence, you've seen all of these campaigns in America today where they say, I want you to sign a no tax increase pledge, etc. Maybe we've got to create a movement that says, I want you to sign a pledge that there will be no negative personal ads run about your opponent in this campaign. I remember when I first ran for Congress, I ran against Al Baldus, and I can honestly tell you that Al Baldus and I were better friends at the end of that campaign than we were at the beginning. We spent time in debates, we spent time in the parades and the community celebrations, and we never attacked each other personally. We literally stood up and said, you know, here's my view for America. Al Baldus is a great guy, but I disagree with him. He would say Steve Gunderson's a nice guy, but I disagree with him. And at the end, we were friends. That's the kind of atmosphere that doesn't exist in politics today.
Let's go to Frank next. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Hello, Frank.
Hello. Fine guest, and it's very good to celebrate someone who is both positive and irascible. You know, so niceness is not necessarily a criterion, but perhaps faithfulness is, you know, for success in public life. I would like to ask Mr. Gunderson a question about the failure to deal with a combined climate change and energy policy bill and the role of Lindsey Graham, who has been subject to personal attacks, but he was a key person who was trying to facilitate a bipartisan solution. And he claims that it's the immigration bill that has caused him to withdraw from the arena. So do we have a chance of getting back to something substantive this year if they dodge the immigration controversy and go on to other legislation, finance reform and an energy policy that it looks towards a sustainable economy? Is that possible? So thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank.
Well, Frank, thanks for the nice words. I don't think it's possible anymore, and I don't think it relates to immigration and whether that is scheduled before or after energy. I think the whole issue of what we are dealing with, the disaster in the Gulf, prevents the kind of bipartisan immigration or energy reform that we all would like. Because in order to get energy reform, you have to have both some incentives to move America towards energy independence and some incentives to deal with the carbon issue. And right now, the offshore oil drilling issue is obviously off the table. And I don't think the dual pillars of nuclear and some kind of carbon response is sufficient to get a bipartisan legislative package. Again, this may be one of those issues where timing is our enemy, and just like immigration, we can deal with it better once we get beyond the moment of the day.
Thanks, Frank, as always, for your calls. Let's go next to Betty. Betty is calling from Oak Creek. Hi, Betty.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is, why? Pass some laws, get rid of those lobbyists. They're in the pocket of almost every one of the, maybe every one of the elected officials. And also, why does it take 2 years to run for a president and how many million dollars? Cut these campaigns down to 3 months, and then let these politicians run on their record like Proxmire used to do.
All right, Steve Gunderson.
Yeah, I actually agree with you that our election cycles are too long. I think Britain has showed us that you can have shorter election cycles, and certainly with the kind of 24/7 communication that we have today, we don't need a 1 to 2 year election cycle for a president or a member of Congress. Actually, I don't think the problem is lobbyists as much as it is the impact of campaign financing. Lobbyists, frankly, are for the most part issue experts. And I will tell you, for example, rural hospitals have lobbyists. Teachers have lobbyists. Farmers have lobbyists. There are many lobbyists who are experts on an issue, and no member of Congress can be an expert on every issue you deal with. So having a lobbyist there to give you answers is not necessarily bad. What I think you are saying correctly is the power of political fundraising and political money is distorting the political process. And I do think we've got to look at that issue. But I'd separate campaign finance and political finance from the role of a lobbyist.
Thank you, Betty, very much for the call. So are you ever going to run for office again?
Well, you know, it's a great question, and I loved and cherished the 22 years I spent in office. But I have to tell you, I couldn't get nominated today.
Really?
I mean, I'm a moderate Republican, and there is no way I could be nominated today to run for office. So I cherish and sort of jokingly smile at the fact that, you know, timing in politics is so important. I was there at the right time.
Well, you don't have to run as a Republican or as a Democrat, do you?
Well, you know, I don't know that we're quite ready to elect independents, although I think the race in Florida for Senate is going to be a pretty interesting race. And I'm not sure we're that far away from finding a very, very serious, credible candidate for president as an independent. But you have to have that statesman or stateswoman who brings such impeccable resume. I mean, Colin Powell was that example. He could have ran as an independent, and frankly, he could have probably won as an independent, as a person of color.
I agree.
Because of what he brought to that discussion, but it was also the politics of the day. So I tend to believe that once we get beyond the economy and the challenges, I don't see the Tea Party as a sustaining definition of politics. I think it is a reflection of the politics of the moment.
Steve Gunderson, great to have you on the air. Thank you so much.
I'm delighted to do it. Good luck.
Thanks. You too. Steve Gunderson, former member of Congress and the Wisconsin State Legislature, and he is now president and CEO of the Council on Foundations. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Peace for producing this very interesting hour. Thanks to Glenn Moberg as well, and thanks to Rhonda for doing all the production of this show here today. We'll be back.